Seema Herman never expected that what she thought was a harmless habit, vaping, would end up nearly killing her.
It took 2 days for my lungs to fail, and I almost died.
The 18-year-old going viral with this photo from her hospital bed, a tube still pumping oxygen to her failing lungs. In her hands, a call to action.
Asked for like a pen and paper because that was the only way I could communicate. And I wrote, I want to start a no vaping campaign. That was the first thing I did when I opened my eyes.
Seema's story is just the latest in a landslide of incidents linked to vaping, sparking what many officials are calling a national health crisis.
Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am your host, Catherine Mangy Ward, filling in for Matt Welsh, who is in an undisclosed location. I am joined today by my colleagues, Peter Suderman and Nick Gillespie, as well as special guest star, senior editor Jacob Sullum. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Happy
hey,
Monday.
How are you doing?
It is a happy Monday, but it is not a happy Monday for people who like vaping. We are very lucky to have the world's foremost expert on e-cigarettes with us here. I'm going to go ahead and give you that title, Jacob. Does that sound fair? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
we're going to do that.
Does it come with an honorarium?
To talk with us about the really impressively rapid pace at which we have gone from quite a lot of people vaguely thinking that e-cigarettes or vaping was a safe alternative to smoking, to people being completely sure that every teenager that so much looks as a jewel will die. I'd like to start by just having you, Jacob, sort us out a little bit on the basic facts. You have been on this beat for dog's years. You have been pitching stories about e-cigarettes for Reason Magazine before anybody had any idea what they were or cared at all. So give us a little backstory here. Is vaping actually dangerous, she said in a John Stossel voice?
Well, the first thing to note is that the overwhelming majority of these cases involve, first of all, cannabis products, not nicotine products.
You mean the overwhelming majority of the cases where someone appears to have been harmed in the process of vaping, right?
Right. Of what we are calling vaping-related or vaping-associated respiratory illnesses. The vast majority of cases where they have the information, the people actually use cannabis extracts, typically purchased on the black market. So it is quite a leap to go from that situation to condemning vaping in general or e-cigarettes in general or products like Juul. I have not seen any indication so far that legal nicotine delivering e-cigarettes are implicated in any of these cases, let alone any of the deaths. The CDC just confirmed in a recent study that the vast majority of patients who said what product they used admitted that they used THC. And we have to assume that some patients who did use THC don't want to admit it, because in most cases, this is happening in states where it's still illegal. So they would be admitting breaking the law. So you have to assume there's some cases where patients claim they vaped only nicotine, but actually also vaped cannabis products. Even if some cases involve just nicotine, it's not at all clear what products we're talking about. Because when you talk about vaping or e-cigarettes with nicotine, and people could be buying counterfeit pods on the black market containing God knows what. They could be making fluids themselves using ingredients that may be contaminated. They could be buying ready-made fluids on the black market, again, not knowing what's actually in them. And so the leading theory currently is that there are additives, probably relatively new additives or contaminants, in black market products that are causing most of these problems. And it may be different ingredients depending upon the product. But the reason why it is probably something new is that these cases have only emerged in recent months, whereas people, well, they've been, you know, millions of Americans have been using nicotine e-cigarettes for years. And lots of people have been vaping marijuana in states where it's legal for medical recreational use for years. And yet we're only hearing about this now. So it looks like it's something new, probably more than one thing that's new. And there are a few theories about what's going on. I mean, one of them involves what they call lipoid pneumonia, which happens when you have fat particles in your lungs that you can't expel and might be related to oil-based THC fluids containing vitamin E acetate, which is a nutritional supplement that's fine to swallow, fine to rub on your skin, but maybe not so fine to inhale. So that's one theory that was found in most of the THC vaping products that were analyzed by the FDA and by New York State. But in a recent study by researchers at the Mayo Clinic, they didn't find any evidence to back up that theory. This is a relatively small sample. It was 17 lung tissue samples from patients across the country. And what they found was damage consistent with toxic exposure. So that's a different cause. And probably we are talking about different causes in different cases. In Utah, for example, it seems to be 94% of the patients admitted that they had used cannabis products. I think they detected vitamin E acetate in all of those cases, or nearly all of those cases. So the leading theory there is lipoid pneumonia, whereas in other places it may be toxins that are either residues from processing the fluids, or possibly something that's introduced by faulty vaporizers. There might be dangerous chemicals that are introduced because of the way the heated coils interact with the fluid. So there are lots of possibilities, especially if you're dealing with black market products where you don't know where it was produced or what's in it, and it may have gone through several different people's hands before you finally bought it.
So Nick, we've talked about this argument before, but I wonder, is it fair to say actually these deaths and illnesses are making the point that the people that I would generally see as on the other side of this debate from us make, which is, listen, this is unproven. This is a new technology, and we should be really, really careful with new mm-hmm. technologies and regulate it and study it for a decade before we let it on the market. Do you think the way that this has gone down has strengthened the case at all for a kind of precautionary approach to medical devices?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's off the top of my head, I would say not really, partly because what's going on is so small at this point, and it's not exactly clear what's going on. And I suspect, and Jake can talk to this in terms of old claims about secondhand smoke and things like that, that the number of confounding variables is so potentially huge. So that when people say, I wasn't doing anything kind of screwed up except for vaping, and suddenly I have popcorn lung or pneumonia or whatever, that can only be explained by vaping. That remains to be seen. But there's the larger question, which is a good one, which is almost everybody agrees that vaping is preferable to smoking. And for cigarette smokers or tobacco users, that this is a preferable technology, at least in the time being. So the idea, and what we've seen, which I think is really stunning, is the quickness that you were alluding to, Catherine, in your opening remarks, where whole companies and whole states or cities and towns are moving to ban vaping, which is a really knee-jerk reaction, which I think is something that should be avoided. And also the idea that product liability remains to be seen, which, you know, how that's going to play out in this context. But it is true that, like, when you start using a new technology, you're going to be taking more risks than something that's been around and that has been proven and vetted by experience and or certifying groups.
So my answer to this is always just to say, yeah, it would be great if we could skip right to the part where Pfizer makes these and sells them to everyone in totally uniform quality and quantity over the counter in the drugstore. I know that we can't always necessarily skip right there.
Pfizer has competing products.
But I was just about to say, there are some interesting yeah. incumbents in this market. There's some rent seeking going on. There's some dynamics in the regulation here. Jacob, can you talk a little bit about how the tobacco companies are exacerbating and or ameliorating this mess?
Well, I mean, the one thing that's clear, which Nick mentioned, is that getting nicotine from e-cigarettes is far less hazardous than getting it from smoking a standard cigarette and inhaling all the smoke that's generated when you burn tobacco. That is undeniable, indisputable scientifically. And if you look at the fine print of what the CDC and the FDA are saying, you will see that they are conceding that. They say down the list of their recommendations, there's one that says, if you are a smoker who has switched to e-cigarettes, don't go back to smoking. So they're saying you're much better off, you know, using e-cigarettes, despite the fact that otherwise they're giving the impression that these e-cigarettes might just kill you. So there's a little bit of a mixed message there, because they're issuing general warnings about vaping and e-cigarettes. Only recently have started to say, in particular, THC, which really has been apparent for at least a month or more. And the overall message is such that people are being led to believe that this product, which is in fact much less hazardous than conventional cigarettes. And we know that because they analyze the output of both of these things and compare them, and they can see what chemicals are in them. There are far fewer hazardous chemicals generated by e-cigarettes and at far lower levels. So there's no question about that. But it's vague warnings about vaping and e-cigarettes, which people will often interpret to mean nicotine products, has caused a lot of people, including smokers who have switched, smokers who are thinking about or were thinking about switching, to decide, I don't want to take my chances with e-cigarettes. I'm going to either go back to smoking or just continue smoking. And that's exactly the wrong choice in terms of health hazards. If you want to reduce your health hazards, it's clear that you should stick with vaping, not go back to smoking. It's clear that if you're interested in reducing your health hazards as a smoker, that switching to vaping would dramatically reduce them. And unfortunately, if you look at the polling on this, it's very clear that these messages about how dangerous vaping in general is have had an impact, because most people, when asked what do you think is at fault, mainly at fault for these respiratory illnesses, they say e-cigarettes delivering nicotine. And far fewer say the correct answer, which is that it's mainly black market cannabis products. So already Americans did not have a clear idea of the huge difference in risk between vaping and smoking. And now the scare about lung disease has only compounded that problem. Awareness of the fact that there is this huge difference in risk has actually decreased, even as the evidence that e-cigarettes are much safer than conventional cigarettes has piled up. And by the way, I mean, you mentioned competing products made by pharmaceutical companies. There's a controlled clinical study that found that e-cigarettes are twice as effective as products like nicotine patches or nicotine gum in helping people quit smoking.
I was hoping you were going to say so that's twice as effective at just delivering nicotine. Like, they just are really, really good at the nicotine, which is also a relevant consideration, right?
Which, given that the competing product is literally a patch that puts nicotine in your blood,
right.
It's kind of impressive.
Impressive, I suppose.
Well, I think it's actually, the reason why it's more effective is that it delivers nicotine in a satisfying way. I mean, that is key to this. It resembles smoking in the sense that you're inhaling something, but again, you're not inhaling tobacco combustion products, which is why it's so much safer. So if you ask smokers, why is this better for you than the gum or the patches? They'll say something along the lines of, this is more like what I'm used to. This delivers nicotine in a way that's more similar to smoking, but without, you know, all of the smoke. So that's a huge improvement in terms of the health hazards that the individual faces. And in terms of public health, which everybody claims to be, you know, trying to protect, it is completely insane to be scaring people away from this potentially life-saving
product. I think it's important to go back real quick to the confusion that you talked about between amongst the public, where the public seems to believe that the health risks, that the cases of people getting sick recently are caused by over-the-counter legal vaping products. And I want to focus on that just a little bit, because I think the FDA, perhaps not directly, but at least inadvertently, the FDA has been in part responsible for encouraging that. And the FDA's response to all of this has been to move forward with a crackdown on flavored e-cigarettes. So flavored e-cigarettes are not what's causing the problem. Their argument, though, is that these things are tempting to kids, and that what they want to do is stop kids from starting up vaping. And they are attempting to make a link here between over-the-counter flavored cigarettes and banana or watermelon raspberry or whatever, and the health issues that we have seen pop up in the last couple of months. And there was an interesting LA Times story just a week ago about how the FDA was actually trying to do this under the Obama administration, and the Obama administration shut them down, but that this was something that was happening in 2015 and 2016 under the previous administration, and is now appears to be going forward under the Trump administration. And so the FDA's response to what is pretty clearly a crisis of black market adulterated THC vapes is to ban over-the-counter flavored vapes, which, and like, you have these quotes in the LA Times story where there's this attorney who is a public health attorney, and he says, well, you know, if you look back at what the Obama administration FDA decided to do, this was the moment we'd go back to in a time machine, the moment we could have nipped this disaster in the bud. There's no reason to think that this would have made any positive difference. And if anything, the opposite is true, because if you had banned those, if you had banned those flavors, what you would do is you would create an even larger black market and more opportunity for people to be buying more or more demand for black market goods that are more likely to be adulterated. And so what the FDA is doing here is not just something dumb, not just something that's sort of like, well, we're going to pursue the agenda we already had, but they are doing something that is probably counter to public health. There's actually going to make the situation, the precise situation that appears to be causing this, worse.
Jacob, you've written about this somewhat, the idea that public health crusaders will kind of formulate a plan and then wait for the crisis to kick the plan into effect. And this really does seem to be a case of that, right? Like the FDA has been working on a plan to ban some form of vaping for at least as long as Scott Gottlieb had been in office. And
longer.
In fact,
I mean,
as Peter just described, much, much longer. Are there other examples of kind of how that trajectory has gone down that can maybe tell us what's going to happen next with the vaping stuff?
Well, I should make it clear that the FDA does not claim, they're not claiming this is a response to the lung disease. They are claiming this is a response to big increases in underage vaping. The FDA is at fault in sending mixed messages to the public about how to respond to these lung disease cases, saying things like, well, if you're concerned, maybe you should just not vape at all, and sort of conflating with those warnings the two really different categories of products, black market cannabis products on the one hand and legal nicotine e-cigarettes on the other.
But
in terms of the ban on flavored e-cigarettes, what they are saying is this is necessary to stop an epidemic of nicotine addiction among teenagers. But if you look at the data they're relying on, the data show that among teenagers who don't smoke, it's actually quite rare to see them using e-cigarettes on a daily basis or showing signs of addiction like craving or wanting to vape right when they get sort of thing. So it's actually not an epidemic, but they are worried that, I mean, what Gottlieb said is, I imagine a whole generation of young people, you know, becoming addicted to nicotine because of these products, and we're trying to stop that. It was a huge overreaction to what was admittedly a troubling trend. But when you break down the data, the problem is not nearly as serious as he portrayed it. And furthermore, I would say, to the extent that teenagers who otherwise would be smoking are instead vaping, that's actually an improvement from a public health point of view. And there's indications of that, because the downward trend in smoking among teenagers and young adults actually accelerated as e-cigarettes became
more
popular.
To be clear, that's why I said the FDA maybe wasn't encouraging this directly, but the timing of the FDA's announcement of the crackdown on flavored e-cigarettes has been conflated in the public mind. Again, not because the FDA is making a direct claim themselves. But you do see, like I said, there are people, there are public health attorneys, there are people in the sort of broader public health community who are pushing that conflation even further. And the timing has mixed it up in the public mind and given, I think, the wrong impression to a lot of people.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. That's definitely happening.
Can I just also add, these are not necessarily black market THC products. When I was in Las Vegas and Los Angeles over the summer, I bought a bunch of completely legal or above ground THC vaping products. So,
did they kill you? Is that what you're saying?
I feel like I'm dead most of the time, but I felt that way
before. Inside before so.
Just to be clear, there have been at least a couple of cases in Oregon, fatalities where the patients, before they died, obviously, reported that they bought these vape pens in state licensed stores. So it may be that in some cases, you're talking about state legal products. But if so, it seems like it has to be something new that has been introduced into the supply, because otherwise we would have seen these cases before now. And so, for example, to the extent, assuming that vitamin E acetate is a problem, and if it's true that some state licensed businesses started to use that as a thickening agent in their THC fluids, then that may be part of the problem. But overwhelmingly, what we're seeing is that people are getting sick in states where it's not even legal. So they're clearly getting it on the black market. And you have things that are represented as being quasi-legal products, the black market producers can buy the packaging online and make it look like it's some kind of reputable brand, but it's whatever they threw together and stuck in a cartridge. So, you know, this is a perennial problem with the black market is you don't know what you're getting. And if you have any hope of trying to have transparency and control and making sure that people know what they're getting, it
and has to be clear, even for state legal products, they're still existing in a gray market, right? I mean, these products are still formally illegal at the federal level. They are still operating in a way that is not as codified and formal. They don't have the benefit of using lots of third-party services, including, for instance, banking, that legitimate businesses in a state would have in any other industry. So there are ways that that handicaps even state legal producers to make them act and look more like and to have more of the risks of a black or a gray market.
I mean, I assume that when you bought your vape pens in Las Vegas, you just paid in casino tokens?
Well, no, it's interesting to go to, and Congress is actually addressing banking issues, but you can pay in cash or ATM cards, but you can't use credit cards because they have to be authenticated in a different way. But having said that, these all of the producers and all of the products in the dispensaries that I went to were clearly packaged. They had addresses on them. I mean, these are building these are businesses that have massive capitalization behind them. So they have every incentive. You know, everybody knows where the owners are, where the producers are, and things like that. So they actually do have every incentive to make sure their products are as safe and effective as possible.
Yeah, it's definitely bad for business to kill your customers.
Unless it's Murder Incorporated.
I want to do just a quick informal survey of the folks here on the podcast.
Jacob
about
is high right now. Yes, I saw him.
I actually wasn't.
He was injecting CBD oil directly
marijuana
into
his eyeballs. Yeah. So, you know, I actually just wanted to ask, like, many of us either use or know people who use THC vapes. This has been kind of the talk of the town. I have been interested when I've talked to people about this, that there does seem to be an underlying understanding that the risk is, in fact, very low. So even though the conversation starts, oh, my God, all these people are dying from the vapes, the conversation ends, yeah, I'm not actually going to throw away my old cartridges. I'm just going to use those because I probably won't die because I didn't die before when I used them. I'm very interested in that kind of like intuitive understanding that people have sometimes of a low risk thing that we are still having a public panic about. So I'm just interested in your experiences, either personally, if you want to disclose that on the air, or, you know, some guy you know that you could tell us a story about. Like, have you had that? Have you had that same experience?
Corn Pop?
You could tell us about whether Corn Pop still vapes? Yeah.
I just think that vaping pot is by far the best way to consume it. I didn't always have great experiences with smoking joints, sort of in my 20s. And it wasn't really until vaping came around. And I don't do it very often. I mean, it's pretty infrequent. But when I have, it's just a much, much better experience, much more consistent, much easier, on my body physically and on my lungs, right? There's none of this sort of harsh coffee, like, wait, did I just swallow maybe a little bit of glass or something? I will also say that sort of high concentration CBD pills, which are a slightly lighter gray legal zone, fulfill a lot of the same role and do a lot of the same sort of like help you relax when you need to sleep kind of work. And the semi-legal markets that we have now that have made this stuff available have just have been a huge improvement in my life because small amounts of this stuff, when I'm a little stressed out, help me sleep a lot.
And Peter, let me ask you something. Do you own any guns?
I do not.
Good answer, because I'm trying to.
I live in Washington, D.C.
Trying to implicate you in a federal felony. Yeah, I've heard.
I have shotguns, but I do not own any.
I have friends who are not vaping anymore, not vaping marijuana anymore, because of this. I think it's an overreaction to the extent that they're using products produced in states where it's legal.
Are they smoking weed then? They're smoking rather than vaping?
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. Or some cases, eating edibles. Yeah. I mean, I don't like edibles. I don't like having to wait for it to come on. I don't like the uncertainty about whether the dose is adequate or inadequate. I don't like smoking either because of all the combustion products. And you know, on the face of it, vaping has got to be less bad for your lungs than inhaling all of these carcinogens. I mean, anytime you burn anything and inhale the smoke in your lungs, you're exposing yourself to all sorts of hazardous chemicals. It's also highly inefficient, because you burn up so much of the product. So yeah, I would say that vaping, you know, out of the gate looked like a better option. Drops on the tongue are a good compromise, or beverages, which tend to get absorbed faster than solid foods. So, you know, some people may be moving to that until it becomes clear what's going on with the marijuana vapes.
I will actually, just to correct my previous statement, the actual best way to get marijuana is through the pot brownies recipe that Catherine Mengi Ward published in Reason magazine. That's, and I'm not just saying that to get literal brownie points with my editor.
But think of that. You're forestalling, y'all. You know, from the minute you think, oh, I want some pot brownies, to baking them, it's like hours.
I mean,
not if someone has already made them for you.
Yeah. If, for example, you work here in the Reason DC office.
And they are individually wrapped and milligram labeled, and it's just...
It's very handy.
One of the things that I do think is interesting about the rise of marijuana vaping, and this may also have something to do with people who vape nicotine as well, the ease with which it's done changes use patterns. And I have to admit, you know, I've tried marijuana vaping products and I've smoked weed for decades, but I don't particularly care for it. And I haven't done it in a couple months and I don't plan to going back. But I noticed when you first get it, it's so much easier to vape marijuana. I mean, it's literally on demand. You don't have to roll anything. You don't have to pack anything. You don't have to leave anywhere, because even though vaping is illegal, and Jacob has written about this in the past, just because it mimics smoking, you know, it was banned from airplanes and bathrooms and office buildings and apartment buildings for no good reason, but other than its similarity to smoking. But I do wonder if people who vape marijuana tend to consume a significant amount more. And also with nicotine, with vaping, you know, tobacco products or vaping nicotine products, it's so easy. I would suspect that people are actually doing it a lot more. And with marijuana, that presents it's a different use experience where it's so much easier to stay stoned all day.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends, you know, what your pattern was even with smoking, but if you're trying to get a certain amount of high, you get there and you stop. I mean,
you see, that's where you're all wet, buddy. You're getting a certain amount of high and then you can always go a little higher.
The feeling of just being so stoned that I can't even like follow a conversation.
I think we've established you're an atypical drug use.
Other people may prefer that.
Yeah.
But in the case of nicotine, I would say, I think it is true, nicotine vaping versus cigarettes, that because it's so much easier. I mean, they say that like a Juul pod is the nicotine equivalent of a pack of cigarettes. It's very easy. If you become accustomed to doing that while you're working, it's very easy to go through a pod or two, you know, in a few hours, which is probably, you're probably taking in more nicotine,
right,
than you would. And then you get
satisfied with that. I mean, you get comfortable with that and you want to buck up.
Yeah,
I mean, nicotine has a certain saturation.
But it just becomes habitual if it's easy to do and it's something you're used to doing in a certain context. Now, I've used them and I do find them useful for focusing on work, but now I'm on a trip and I'm not using it for days and I'm not feeling, you know, craving for it. Hmm. But once you're back in the situation where you're used to doing it, it becomes habitual.
This also kind of taps into the underlying Puritanism question, or the kind of underlying debate about when this crosses into not just libertarianism, but libertinism. And I do find myself sort of torn on it. Part of me wants to say, yeah, oh no, God forbid people should consume more of a couple of substances that give them pleasure. I mean, the vast majority of users of both of these substances are not debilitated by them. The vast, vast, vast majority are not debilitated by them. You know, we've found ways to deliver them that are easier and more efficient and have lower health risks overall. That should be a win. Why do we act like it's a disaster.
Well, so there are new costs, and that's, I think, what sort of that people fail to compare the new costs to the old costs. And the question shouldn't be, if we legalize pot and we legalize vaping pot all over the country, will there be some behaviors that are that some people regard as socially negative, that are perhaps bad for the individual users who choose to engage in them? I think the answer is, we could probably all agree, is it sure that is yes, to some extent. Some people will abuse a legal pot, legal vaping situation. The question is that abuse? Are the new problems better or worse than the problems that are caused by the current regime by keeping pot illegal? And I think it's pretty clear, certainly to all of us, I think everyone here would agree that the problems of illegality are much, much worse and much harder to solve because they sort of involve criminalization, and because everything gets pushed underground, they end up being much worse and much harder to solve and much more destructive to both individuals and the social fabric, to the extent that we agree that there is such a thing, than a legal regime is.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I don't know from what kind of philosophical point of view, other than a pure kind of, a communistic public health model, that you wouldn't say that when you do the cost-benefit analysis, you don't end up concluding that even if a small percentage of people, or even maybe a significant percentage of people, end up abusing a product that becomes legal, that you should make it illegal, especially when you factor in the added costs of, if something is illegal and people are abusing it, it makes it that much harder for them to seek help or to get help. It just,
and also to seek redress.
It's an ongoing issue.
To seek redress. I mean, if you imagine a situation in which vaping pot is totally legal in every state, and also there's no federal prohibition against it, we would know the company that was making this stuff. We would be able to sue them. We would be able to, right? There would be actions that could be easily taken. And it's much, much harder now when people are getting things shipped to them in anonymous boxes from, Omaha, from two guys in a townhouse somewhere who have set up a black market operation, and you have no idea where in China they're getting their cutting agents from. And if you can even find them, they've disappeared. And the legality makes redress and makes address, sort of fixing these problems when they show up, much, much easier. And it also gives, as you said earlier, huge incentives to the firms that are making this stuff to avoid these problems to begin with.
Before we get to the next topic, though, is there something that interferes with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp Online Counseling is here for you. It's a service that connects you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's super convenient, and you can do it on your own time in a secure video or phone session, plus chat or text with a therapist. They can help you with all kinds of problems, including depression, stress, anxiety, sleeping trouble, trauma, anger, or anything that happens on a normal Tuesday at Reason. Anything you share is confidential, and if you don't like your counselor, you can switch to a new one at any time for no additional charge. You can tap into a broad network of expertise that might not be locally available in your area, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. It's a truly affordable option, and Reason listeners will find it even more affordable. They can get 10% off of their first month with the discount code Reason. Get started today at betterhelp.com/reason. Fill out a questionnaire, find a counselor you love. That's betterhelp.com/reason. Okay, everybody hit your vape pens. It is time for us to talk about politics. I am sorry, but it has to be done, because in the last, 72 hours, the President of the United States has called for Representative Adam Schiff, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, also Mitt Romney, and probably a few other people to be impeached and or indicted for treason. We have a second whistleblower, maybe, who has emerged in the case of the Ukrainian phone call, which is what we're going to call this from now on. We have
Is this a Hardy Boys mystery or a Nancy Drew?
Definitely Nancy Drew, for sure. Nancy Drew forever.
Nancy Pelosi Drew?
Quote unquote Pelosi Drew. Yes. So I guess what I want to talk with you guys about, first of all, Peter, I'm going to start with you because you live in Washington, D.C. and pay attention to these things.
So do you, buddy.
I'm pretending I don't. Has the case for impeachment of Donald Trump strengthened in the last couple of days? And has the fact that the president is now calling for the impeachment of literally any person who crosses him on Twitter, is that a symptom? Is this something he's actually been doing all along? He has not shied away in the past from using the word treason to describe the actions of his opponents. Is this a I'm rubber and you're glue, everything you say bounces off me and sticks to you problem? What is going on, Peter?
Momentum for impeachment certainly has increased in the past couple of days. What I guess I would say is that if you think that the president of the United States asking not just one foreign government, but now we're up to at least two and possibly more, multiple foreign governments to investigate a political rival is an impeachable act. If you believe that, then the case has strengthened because we've gone from having the reconstructed transcript of the Ukrainian phone call between Trump and the Ukrainian leader in July released to Trump saying basically on the White House lawn that China and Ukraine should investigate the Bidens. And he's saying this in front of lots of cameras, in front of the press, very openly. And then he's and then to follow up, you know, sort of when Democrats are like, wow, he's just coming out and saying it. He is saying that Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, his Democratic opponents, have committed treason and should be impeached themselves. So if that's a strengthening of the case in your mind, then yes. I mean, certainly it's just now much more out in the open than it was even a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure that we have actually seen more momentum towards or much more momentum towards the eventual removal of President Trump. And so if you just to sort of back up a little bit here, the process is that the House has to go through this whole rigmarole and recommend articles of impeachment. And then if Trump, even if he is impeached in the House, then it goes to the Senate, and you would need two-thirds of the Senate to vote to actually remove him, which means you would need 20 Republican senators. And right now, there are, as far as I can tell, there are three. There's Mitt Romney, there's Ben Sasse, and there's Susan Collins. And they have not even said, well, that they would actually remove him, but they've issued statements of great concern. They're very troubled, capital T, troubled by what's going on. And they're the kind of senators who have always been a little bit mixed on Trump and have always, you know, sort of taken a time to say, well, whenever Trump does something that's kind of awful, this is very, very bad and I am deeply troubled. But it's not even clear that they would vote to remove at this point, certainly if there weren't enough votes. And this is a weird dynamic that you have to think about. There will only be enough votes if there are enough votes. And I know that that's obviously tautological, but think about it.
Man, you did hit the vape pen before this segment.
Yeah.
But if you need 20 Republican senators plus every Democrat, then you're only going to get 20 if everybody sees that there are a full 20. If the count looks like it's going to be 16, then the actual vote will be three or four Republican senators, not all of the 16 who might have voted in a potential yes situation where there were a full 20 will go ahead and vote yes. And so these votes and these vote counts end up being very dynamic and very fluid. We're months away from a Senate trial. And the other thing is, though, that I would just say that we have these couple of senators, this trio of Republican senators that have come out and said, well, this is very troubling. What Trump did was obviously wrong. Even they are not saying that they want to do removal. And it's also just very difficult to come up with a list of 20 who might flip here. And the only way that I can see that happening, basically, is if Mitch McConnell looks at the poll numbers, in particular amongst Republicans who support Trump, and you just start to see a huge, huge drop in Republican support for President Trump. If that happens and Mitch McConnell believes that removal will actually result in more Republican seats being held or gained in the 2020 election, then Trump is going to be out if Mitch McConnell wants it to happen. But until that happens, I just don't see Republicans in the Senate voting for removal.
I continue to enjoy your absolutely consistent portrait of Mitch McConnell as like the most sinister human abacus ever to exist.
He's not. He's almost not sinister.
He is perfectly cynical.
He has no.
He's a piece of garbage.
Ideological goals except that he wants to maintain the largest number of Republican seats and thus the most amount of power that he can have for himself.
Jacob, you've written about this.
Look, and if this is, if I can just say, if there, you know, if Trump, I view Trump's presidency as this moment of clarification, because he's forcing everybody on every side of every issue to kind of either own their principles or admit that they're much more kind of situational ethicists. Mitch McConnell is actually, he is the rot at the center of the, I think, of the American governmental system, because he doesn't have actual principles. He vaguely talks about limited government, et cetera, but he's happy to spend money, you know, that we don't have on programs we don't need as long as it benefits his constituencies or his team.
His team in particular. Remember what he told President Trump? No politician has ever lost by spending more money. This was on the eve of one of the big budget deal things that President Trump had to sign. That was Mitch McConnell's advice, was spend more money to win seats, because that's what Mitch McConnell cares about.
If we can, you know, if we can actually make the most of this moment, it is that Mitch McConnell really needs to be moved front and center to what is wrong with the American government and why people treat it so cynically and have no trust or confidence in it. Because we know that Mitch McConnell, who is a hugely powerful person, you know, absolutely is just, you know, he has no there. He's a paper mache Mephistopheles, to use a phrase from Joseph Conrad in Heart of Darkness, to describe a lower functionary who's part of the Belgian Congo
system. Wait, now who's hitting the vape pen?
I know, we're all doing great. Jacob, you've written about this, in particular, the question of whether the president has committed crimes and whether that matters. Does it matter?
Probably not. And I think, you know, it is relevant, but it is not necessary to make a case for impeachment. I think what has been alleged, assuming it's all true, is a clear abuse of presidential power, probably also unconstitutional because he allegedly held up these funds for Ukraine for personal political reasons, and he was not authorized to do that. Congress had approved those funds. They were supposed to go where Congress said. And there are a few possible criminal treason is not one of them, by the way. That's not a plausible criminal violation for Trump or for anyone else, except people who go to work for international terrorist organizations. Maybe it has to involve, you know, adhering to America's enemies, organizations or countries with which America is at war. And none of these people, neither Trump nor all the people he's accused of treason, have done that. But there are a few other possible statutes that he, you know, could be said to have violated. Bribery statute, where he could be illegally soliciting a bribe, and the bribe in that case would be dirt on Biden. And assuming that counts as a thing of value that could be seen as soliciting a bribe, there is very similarly a soliciting an illegal foreign campaign contribution. Again, that hinges on the information counting as a contribution. And there is one other statute that involves, and this is the most interesting one to me, it also involves soliciting, trying to get something of value, but in exchange, you are either threatening to withhold a benefit authorized by Congress, or, you know, promising you'll deliver this benefit if they comply. And that's interesting to me because it's not simply a matter of, you know, soliciting an illegal contribution or maybe potentially bribery, but again, it involves the separation of powers, because you are basically using taxpayer money in an illegal way for your own personal purposes. So those are all arguable. People will say, you know, it's not clear whether they apply or not. He's not going to be prosecuted as president in any case. But as with obstruction, you know, the things that he did, even if you buy the theory that he wasn't guilty of obstructing the Russia investigation because he's in charge of the executive branch and he can stop and start investigations at will, that still looks like an abuse of power, even if it doesn't meet the criteria for obstruction. So you could imagine him being impeached for those things as well, even though there is not a provable criminal violation.
Before we leave this topic to talk about porn, which we will definitely be doing shortly, Nick, I want to ask you if you can help me coin some kind of a new phrase. As we have been podcasting this morning, Donald Trump is tweeting about his plan to pull troops from northern Syria and what Turkey's anticipated reaction will be. Is there a term for the opposite of wagging the dog? He's leaving wars, potentially, to distract us from domestic scandal. Do you have some ideas about what we could call
that? Oh, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm always, my go-to phrase is always shit the bed, but that doesn't seem to apply here either. So Like, I'm at a mark it down. I'm at a loss for words.
Petting the cat. Like, should we try to move into other animals?
One of the things to not to go off of the Trump impeachment stuff per se, but it's also kind of awesome that Trump is actually following through with pulling out of Syria, because this, and it is not going to be a pretty sight, but the alternative is to stay enmeshed in places that we shouldn't have been in the first place. And there are better and worse ways to leave behind people who have acted acted with America, such as the Kurds. But really, Trump should be given credit for actually getting us out of Syria and to a large degree out of other parts of the world.
So perhaps related to this week's news, perhaps not, there's been an uptick in conservative calls for the banning of porn. And I want to talk with you guys about that, not least because, again, we have the world's foremost expert. No, just kidding. Jacob is not an expert in porn, as far as I know, though he has covered many interesting constitutional and First Amendment issues related to it. So let's talk about this here. Ross Douthat kicked this off last year with a Let's Ban Porn column in the New York Times. Last week, Zach Slayback in the Daily Caller says that we should ban porn because it's nothing more than a means to an end, not itself entertainment. The launch of the United States edition of The Spectator, they had an article in there calling for the banning of porn as well. Damon Root wrote for Reason Magazine, for Reason.com, a very good law-splainer piece noting that we can't ban porn because porn is protected by the First Amendment and pornography is different than obscenity. But even in these obscenity cases, the Supreme Court of the United States goes out of its way to protect porn that is also kind of art. So I guess my first question is to Peter, which is just like, why now? Why are we having this conversation again, always, forever, but especially right now? Why do conservatives want to ban porn this week in America?
They wanted to ban it last week and the week before and last year. I think there are two reasons, besides the fact that this is actually not all that new. There are two reasons why there is a little bit of a resurgence in the prominence of calls for this. And one is the ubiquity of porn. Now, Pornhub and the internet have been delivering porn on demand for over a decade now. It's been quite prevalent. And yet, even still, in the last couple of years, we've moved into a world where you can assume that literally everyone who is 12 years old or older has a smartphone, has just sort of constant, easy access to the internet. It's made it just a lot more available. And you see this is an issue in public libraries, and you see also it's an issue in schools now with kids and their phones. So it has come to public attention, in particular to the attention of parents who are just having to think about, well, how do we deal with the fact that a lot of kids now have very easy access to this, and it's quite difficult to figure out how to really stop them from viewing porn on their phones or their laptops. And then you combine that with the weird way that Donald Trump has encouraged, enabled, empowered even a small group of reactionary social conservatives, and I'm thinking of folks like Sora Bomari here. And if you go and look at the Sora Bomari arguments that we've talked about on this podcast, the debates he's had with David French, actually one of the points of agreement that he had with David French was about the awfulness of pornography. Now, French was like, French sort of said, I think that the First Amendment should not protect pornography. However, kind of culturally, we've decided that it does. But Amari was just like, well, judges should just be enforcing these statutes, and we should be saying that pornography is illegal, and we should be going after it. And there should be real legal consequences for pornographers, at least, and perhaps even for access or for delivery systems. And so this has been a part of the kind of nascent nationalist, post-liberal conservative movement that has risen up under Donald Trump, in part because, for whatever weird reason, these folks feel like Donald Trump is their champion. And I still just actually can't quite wrap my head around that, and I can't quite figure out why that is the case. But social conservatives, white evangelicals, tend to be the strongest supporters of President Trump, and the sort of the very conservative evangelical political movement has been the core of his political base. And there's an awful lot of support for banning, restricting, taking further legal action against the production and distribution of pornography within that group. And so we're hearing about it a lot more.
Jacob, is the Supreme Court basically right in the balance that it has currently struck, or should obscenity also be protected by the First Amendment?
Well, obscenity is bullshit, really.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the definition, it has three parts, each of which is utterly subjective. And there is a serious question as to whether anything can be found obscene anymore in the U.S. And if so, what are the distinctions they're using? Because it really... I mean, maybe things that are especially kinky. If you get a jury and it's an especially kinky kind of porn that may not appeal to them, maybe they'd be more likely to find somebody guilty. I mean, I don't know if you remember the John Stagliano case, where the thing that offended the prosecutors was this genre of porn that involves squirting milk out of bodily orifices, yep. Which is weird, but I don't know that that's fundamentally more disgusting than anything else that appears in pornography.
You know, for the lactose intolerant.
And the idea, you know, just and, really, and in the end, they didn't actually reach the issue because the case was short-circuited for other reasons. But it comes down to things like that. Is like, what will, you know, 12 people think is gross, which is weird. And it creates not just a First Amendment issue, but also a fundamental rule of law issue. If nobody knows what's actually banned, what's prohibited, what you can be prosecuted for, that's a serious problem. And I don't buy this argument that, oh, this is purely a product that helps you masturbate, because that's what these conservatives are saying, right? So we can regulate or ban it the way we do other products. And it's obviously not true. I mean, there is pornography that tells a story. There's pornography that has some artistic merit. And remember that the part of the definition of obscenity is that it has no serious artistic, literary, scientific, or political value, right? So clearly there is some pornography that has some of that value. Whether it's serious or not is totally a matter of opinion. And conversely, you know, why should it be the case that there is all this terrible poetry that is indisputably protected by by the First Amendment, but somehow this other material, it has to have not just value in some people's eyes, but serious value as judged by judges or juries. It's really a weird sort of standard. So I don't think it really is tenable anymore. And I would be surprised, I mean, even assuming that a president who sleeps with porn stars is interested in going after pornography, I would be surprised if they were successful. I mean, you'd have to find a very conservative jurisdiction applying, you know, conservative community standards. And even then, I would be surprised if they can get a jury to convict and, you know, send somebody to prison for producing the stuff, which, you know, people are consuming for the most part in their privacy of their homes. And by the way, you know, Peter mentioned the proliferation on the internet is a problem for people worried about, you know, I mean, it's a 12-year-old's dream come true, but for their parents, it might be alarming. But at the same time, it is, in a sense, making it less conspicuous because all of the, you know, these adult video stores, most of them have gone out of business. So these, you know, places where you go, public landmarks where you go to get pornography and sex toys and so on, you know, a lot of they're mostly going out of business because of the.
And even HBO has canceled all of their old softcore programming that used to be sort of like one of the things that they.
Oh, so like The Hitcher and things like that.
So they used to do a show, I think it was HBO that did like the kind of quasi documentary about the Cat House, the Moonlight Bunny Ranch, and a few things like that. Mm-hmm. And HBO has actually just totally ended that program, at least on HBO. They may own another network that still does some of that, but HBO has just sort of quietly said, nope, we're not doing that anymore.
I do think that the push for regulation of porn is best seen as part of a larger movement. Recently in the New York Times, Andrew Marantz, who's a writer at the New Yorker, wrote a New York Times op-ed, which I think I've mentioned at Reason.com, where he was talking about how it's really time to start, you know, hemming in First Amendment freedom of expression because, you know, bad memes essentially can incite violence in the real world, et cetera. Looking at I think it makes sense to look at these kind of constant burps of attention from the right wing to police porn, and then on the left, it's more to police violence or fantasy violence in popular culture. They stem from a common cause, which is actually the empowerment of more people having the ability to produce and consume whatever they want. And that, if your basic political framework is that certain things are good and certain things are bad, then you want to police speech. And we live in a moment where we have largely, and this goes back at least to the early 60s with a couple of landmark Supreme Court cases that vastly expanded freedom of expression. What we think about as the First Amendment really dates back to the late 50s and early 60s, and then has been abetted by rapid technological innovation. But if your political philosophy is that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and we have an absolute ability to tell the difference, you're always going to be wanting to enforce laws and rules on other people's speech. And it's kind of a chronic infection. It's not, and it's just something that's going to flare up from time to time for whatever reason. And it just needs to be beaten down with an actual, really strong libertarian defense of saying that, freedom of expression is its own justification, and that being able to say what we think and what we speak and what we feel, as long as you're not forcing people to consume it, that is an absolute bedrock value, and that we shouldn't allow people to fuck with that, whether from the right or the left, whether because they're helping children or they're helping addicts or they're helping this or that. We need to live in an open and free society that we finally have achieved. And, screw people who want to run.
As anticipated, our porn segment has provided a perfect segue into the what are you consuming part of our podcast.
Porn.
I mean, we can all just say porn and be done.
Finally got the Bitcoin membership sponsorship of Viewport.
What subchannel?
We are definitely not sharing our specific preferences. I am the host here and I will shut it down. No, I'm going to go first, exercising my moderator tyranny, because it is precisely on topic, and say that I have been listening to a podcast called Bleeped, which is a podcast about censorship. It's pretty good, guys. It's six episodes. It launched in March. They've been coming out. Seems sporadic to me. I'm not sure what the exact release schedule is. The most recent one was about ag-gag laws. That is the laws that prohibit people, even people on public property.
Also a channel.
Yeah, speaking of, actually the name of the segment is Ag Gag Me With a Spoon. So everyone can do what they want in the gutter with those thoughts. Like I say, this is a...
Not if Sora Bamari has anything to do with it.
This is a series of laws that prevent people even on public property sometimes from recording or otherwise doing kind of investigations or investigatory journalism into what is happening on farms or in slaughterhouses. There is also an episode about Drag Queen Story Hour, speaking of Sora Bamari, if you would like to read more or learn more, rather, in your ear holes, as Matt Walsh would say. Nick, what have you been consuming? And I insist again that you do not tell us specifically what porn that has been.
I watched the Joker movie. I went to see it on Thursday or Friday, Joker, and I thought it was an interesting movie that occasioned a great moral panic about the idea that there was going to be all sorts of violence coming out of it. It's not that. I don't know that it's a great work of art, but one of the things that is kind of fascinating is that it shows, it's the origin story of the Joker from a very empathetic point of view, which is one of the reasons why people are upset by it, because it's being read as a kind of apologia for incel culture, for white male anger at a world that is escaping its ability to control, and things like that. But it's worth seeing. And the other thing I watched...
So a lot to relate to in there.
Well, yeah, no, but, it's... I'm not sure it's worth all of the social commentary, but, it was good. It's worth seeing.
I saw it too, and I really found myself very frustrated by the sort of think piece discourse cycle that preceded it, for a bunch of reasons. One of them just that it started a full month before normal moviegoers could see the movie. And so there was this huge sort of weeks-long public fight about whether Joker was going to cause violence, whether it's a dangerous movie, whether it's whatever, before anyone else could see it. And it's just totally that sort of discussion. Forget it's, first of all, it's wrong. And like the idea that the movie is going to cause violence and then Todd Phillip, the director of the movie, is going to have some sort of responsibility for the violence is a bad idea. If somebody goes and shoots up a movie theater, then the person who is responsible for that is the person who shot up the movie theater. But it's also, it doesn't serve readers and viewers. And if you're someone whose job is to discuss movies for a living and to do it in public and to try and help inform and engage readers about movies, you need to kind of wait until that movie happens.
Well, or until that movie is available. Let's face it, a lot of the people commenting it had not seen the movie at all. So it's early on and were warning people.
And so that's the other part, is that there were a bunch of pieces written by people who hadn't seen the movie. As it happens, I really did not like the movie. I found it really kind of repulsive, as I found the Hangover films fairly repulsive. But I just think that the think piece industrial cycle on this one was really kind of awful, and it made it, there was this weird thing where it kind of fundamentally wasn't about the movie itself and about the merits of the movie. It was, if you remember last week, there were people who were really upset with David Brooks because he wrote a column, which I won't comment on the merits of, but he wrote a column that was an imagined conversation with Flyover Man. And every movie critic who is like, well, this movie is potentially dangerous and maybe it's going to make somebody go do something really dangerous and violent, was basically having an imaginary conversation with dumb white male movie
flyover
goer.
Incel. Right.
And it's the exact same sort of we've created a kind of a synthetic person who we're going to imagine and pretend to predict their reactions to. And it's just, it's really, in the case of the Joker commentary, I really found it very frustrating, even while I also didn't love the movie, actually really
say the other, one of the things you mentioned, The Hangover and Todd Phillips' earlier movie, his comments, which prejudiced me against liking the movie going in, when he said, because of cancel culture, basically, you can't do humor anymore. So he can't do movies like Old School or The Hangover franchise, which he, which became shittier and shittier over time. But the other thing I watched over the weekend was the latest season of Big Mouth, the animated Netflix show, which is incredibly bawdy and off color and is great. And I can't stand people who want to shut down speech, but I'm also getting sick of people attacking woke scolds in absentia. When there is massive amounts of off-color humor that is truly great, whether it's a Dave Chappelle special, whether it's Big Mouth, or Comedy Central in mid-September, they did a roast of Alec Baldwin that is absolutely hilarious and great and filled with exactly the kind of humor that supposedly is no longer allowable in America. So, I mean, people really need to kind of, get real about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and it's happening all around us. It bothers me that people are constantly picking one or two examples of something they find bad or shut down and then, making these global comments about stuff that just isn't true. We still live in a great world for getting and making whatever you want on whatever terms you want.
If woke scolds are killing the Hangover trilogy, then they're not killing comedy.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Ouch. Jacob, what are you consuming?
I'm finishing up a very long biography of Frederick Douglass by David Blight, a Yale historian. I think it's Yale. It's actually very good. It hits some important themes like what was the Civil War all about? What was the Constitution all about? Was it, pro-slavery, anti-slavery, neutral? And, Douglass himself changed his views about that over time. It's very illuminating to look at him, his thinking evolving, and him looking at Lincoln and Lincoln's thinking evolving sort of in tandem. And all of the splits within the abolitionist movement, which are some of which were just insane, like the things they were fighting over, given that they shared the same overall goal. How racist a lot of people against slavery were, you know, really brings that home. And just in terms of his personal life, Douglas was like the hardest working man in show business in the 19th century. He was traveling everywhere, and that's how he made a living. And he had all these ne'er-do-well children who never quite managed to leave the nest. And so he was supporting them and his grandchildren.
Why are you looking at me
into
when
old
you say
age?
That,
I just assume this is going to happen with Nick. So all that stuff is interesting. I highly recommend it. The one annoying thing about the book is that Blight keeps talking about how Douglas has been misappropriated or misused by conservatives and libertarians. And he never really explains what he means by that. I mean, he's obviously irked. He obviously thinks, you know, Douglas, even though he was a Republican, belongs to the Democrats and, you know, he was a progressive or whatever. But, you know, he was a classical liberal. So people across the spectrum are going to find things in his thought that appeal to them. But certainly for libertarians to claim him is not at all implausible, given the views that he expressed. The one thing that Blight says that he sees as being inconsistent with libertarianism and maybe conservatism as well is that Douglas, you know, favored vigorous protection for civil rights. Well, yeah, you know, if people are being murdered by racist whites after emancipation, that's a very strong argument for government intervention there. Even things like compensation, you know, he was in favor of giving land to freedmen. Perfectly justified as compensation to take the land away from plantation owners and redistribute it. So I don't really see any libertarian objection to those positions. But aside from that, that's my main quibble. But it's really a good book, and I recommend it.
I do know the in my dissertation, I did a reading of Frederick Douglass's, that he had three versions of his autobiography. One of the progressive arguments or left-wing arguments against Douglas, and it's actually not against libertarians, but it's also what libertarians often point to, is that Douglas, when he went from slavery to earning, you know, wages for his work, he talks about that in like effusive terms of like how fucking great it was to do a job and actually get paid, as opposed to have your master paid and then you get beaten, you know, as like payment for it. And I remember treating and this would have been people who were writing in the late 80s or early 90s, talking about how it was sad that Douglas did not realize. I mean, literally, this is a tight paraphrase that Douglas,
he's a wage slave.
That he could not understand. He was merely exchanging one form of exploitation for another, potentially worse because it's more hidden form of exploitation. And it's kind of like, wow, I remember reading that. And I was like, that takes fucking balls to tell a guy who had experienced chattel slavery and wage slavery that he doesn't know what he's talking about. But that, I think, that's one of the cruxes that people, you know, on the left have trouble with Douglas, and also his religiosity. It's not clear if he was like an actual Christian or if he was using a Christian idiom to push certain
things.
Yeah,
actually, yeah. I mean, that's another good thing about the Blight book is he really gets into Douglas's use of the Bible and in particular the prophets, consults some experts on biblical exegesis and gets into the, you know, delves into the meaning of these various, the metaphors that they come, you know, he used over and over again over the course of his career.
Jacob, thank you very much for joining us for this special edition of the Reason Roundtable. And thank you also to Peter and Nick. I promise that Matt Welsh will come back next week and have us talk about more serious topics than just vaping and porn all the time. I have been your host, Catherine Mangu Ward.
What's more serious than vaping and porn?